Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits. I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS, .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
Hi, I'm Madigan, and you're listening to Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist, a podcast that explores the world through a personal feminist perspective. Hi, everyone. I hope we're doing great. It is still so strange to me not to be recording twice a week, but here I am. I'm doing pretty fantastic, besides the fact that I totally threw my neck out last night, and it didn't help that at like 4 a.m, Penny woke up because she heard animals outside, and I decided to sleep on the couch for the rest of the morning, I guess at that point, which definitely fucked my neck up even more. So now I can't move my head from side to side, but other than that, the sun is out. It's a beautiful day. I have my adorable dog Dorothy next to me, and I'm ready to get into a new episode, one that I am really psyched to talk about. So let's get into it. The Bronte sisters, Charlotte, Emily, and Anne, were all well-known poets and novelists who each lived short but very full lives. Since each of their deaths, the final sister passing away in 1855, their legacy and reputations have grown and evolved. Their books, Agnes Grey, Wuthering Heights, and Jane Eyre, have also remained relevant and popular for now close to 180 years due to each of the sisters' vast imaginations, the truthfulness in their writing, and due to the subject matter of each novel. I, of course, have known about the Bronte sisters for a long time, but I really hate to admit that I've never actually read any of the three books that I just mentioned. I was always really intimidated by the classics when I was younger, and I would use reading a lot as almost like watching TV when I was a kid. I never wanted to get anything that was going to make me think too hard. But now that I'm older, I do enjoy reading those classics more. And now, well, I have a few more books to add to my reading list. The first children born to Patrick and Maria Bronte, born Maria Branwell, were Maria and Elizabeth. Charlotte, Emily, and Anne would all be born within 4 years of each other, with Charlotte coming into the world on April 21st, 1816, Emily on July 30th, 1818, and Anne born on July 17th, 1820. All three of the girls would be born at the parsonage in West Yorkshire, England. It seems that their family history laid the foundation for their future success, as the Bronte family can be traced to the Irish clan, and I'm going to totally butcher this name, even though I'm very Irish myself, O'Printy, a family of hereditary scribes and literary men. Young Patrick was incredibly bright and won a scholarship to St. John's College, or Cambridge, where he studied divinity, ancient history, and modern history. Some believe that it was when attending Cambridge that he became embarrassed of his Irish last name and decided to change it. There's also one last reason as to why Patrick may have wanted to change his name. Apparently, his brother William was on the run from authorities at the time due to his involvement with the United Irishmen, which Patrick seemed to be ashamed of and wanted to distance himself from. Patrick graduated from Cambridge in August of 1806 and became an author of numerous poems, pamphlets, and several newspaper articles. But it seemed that he always had an ambition to work as a member of the clergy. He met and married 29-year-old Maria Branwell in 1812. Maria Branwell was from Cornwall and came from a comfortably well-off middle-class family. Her father had a popular tea and grocery store and a number of other properties around town, and they got pretty rich off of that. Maria met Patrick when visiting her Aunt Jane and Uncle John Fennell in Yorkshire after the deaths of four family members between 1808 and 1812, including both of her parents. Patrick had become friendly with Maria's Uncle Fennell, and when Maria and Patrick met, it was allegedly love at first sight, which was why they were married within a year. They got married on December 29th, 1812, by their mutual friend, Reverend William Morgan, who also married Jane and John Fennell's daughter, Jane Branwell Fennell, on the same day. In fact, there was also another wedding that day. The same hour that Maria was married, Maria's youngest sister, Charlotte, would also be married to her cousin, Joseph Branwell. I mean, at least it's cost effective. The newlywed couple, Patrick and Maria, moved into Claw House in Hightown in Yorkshire. After a few years there, they moved to a parsonage at Haworth, where Patrick took up the role of perpetual curate. A curate, from my understanding, is a person who is invested in the care or cure of a parish, like an assistant to the parish priest. The perpetual curate was a class within the United Church of England and Ireland who acted as an assistant to the priest but got regular pay, I guess. I don't know any of this stuff, so someone reach out and correct me. I think the only important thing to remember here is that Patrick Bronte worked as a member of the clergy. And since he worked as part of the church, Patrick had told Maria that she had to sever ties with her wealthy family, either due to personal reasons or because Patrick worked for a religious order, they had to make some sacrifices and give up most of their material goods. There isn't a whole lot known about the couple's relationship, but by appearances, at the time it seemed that Maria was compliant with disowning her family and most of her things. But I personally am not convinced that a woman who was used to a certain style of living would be so easygoing about living a more meager lifestyle, and I don't know if she would be so cool with her husband being so controlling either. Around Haworth, Patrick was known to have a bit of an unpredictable temperament. He was prone to tantrums while out in public performing his job. Some townspeople told a biographer later that they once heard gunshots fired against a brick wall late at night coming from the Brontes' parsonage. Other evidence of Patrick's controlling nature over Maria was when he once rifled through her personal things and shredded any item of clothing he deemed to be too indulgent. Another story tells of the time that Patrick allegedly also burned pairs of new boots for the girls when they were children. Unfortunately, shortly after moving to Haworth, Maria became ill with either uterine or ovarian cancer, or possibly even chronic pelvic sepsis and anemia brought on by the birth of her youngest daughter, Anne. Maria's sister, Elizabeth Branwell, joined the Bronte Parsonage in 1821 to help look after the children. Whatever the cause, Maria died when Anne was just about 6 months old. Charlotte was 5 and Emily was 3. Maria was buried on September 22nd, 1821, with Reverend William Morgan, the same man who performed her wedding with Patrick, performing her burial ceremony. After this, Patrick tried a few times in vain to remarry, so by the age of 47, he decided to come to terms with his life as a widow. He spent his time visiting the sick and poor, giving sermons and communion, and leaving his daughters, along with their brother Branwell, alone with their aunt, Elizabeth Branwell, who stayed after her sister's death to continue helping to raise the children and their maid, Tabitha, or Tabby. Together, they would all live in what is still known today as the Bronte Parsonage, an unassuming gray stone building set between a graveyard and a vast expanse of moors. Sounds depressing as hell. The girls were each described as being relatively shy as children. I'm sure that only intensified after their mother's death, and the Bronte siblings developed a very close relationship with one another and really relied upon each other. Emily was described as being particularly shy, but very close to her siblings, and was known as a great animal lover. She would often befriend stray dogs she found while wandering the countryside. In August 1824, Patrick sent all of his daughters, Maria, Elizabeth, Charlotte, Emily, and Anne eventually, to the clergy daughters' school in Lancashire. The school was for the daughters of clergy members, as the name of it suggests, and was founded the same year the sisters would begin attendance. There was an old part of the school which housed the teachers, and another building for the school itself and dormitories. The children who attended the school were known as charity children, and they had to wear a uniform, which absolutely humiliated the Bronte sisters, who were amongst the youngest kids boarding there at the time. The Bronte sisters would go on to receive relentless taunting from the older children, particularly Charlotte, who was short-sighted and had to read with her nose pressed to the paper in order to read or write. Here's what their daily schedule looked like at the school. They slept two to a bed with their heads propped up. They were made to get up before dawn to wash themselves up in a basin of cold water, which they shared with six other pupils, and which had also almost always frozen in the night, since the buildings lacked any sort of heating. Then they would pray for an hour and a half before having breakfast of burnt porridge. They began their lessons at 9:30, ending at noon, followed by recreation in the garden until dinner, which was usually eaten quite early. Lessons would then begin again and wouldn't end until 5 p.m., when there was another short break for a half a slice of bread and a small bowl of coffee, then 30 minutes for more recreation time. Then there followed another long period of study, and the day ended with a glass of water, an oat cake, and evening prayers before bed. Then they did it all over again after a few hours of restless sleep. Punishments included food restriction, corporal punishment, and humiliations, such as being made to sit on a stool for hours on end without moving while wearing a dunce's cap. It's always unbelievable to me that they actually used that as a form of punishment and it wasn't just something from cartoons. It does appear that all of the sisters may have used this time in their future novels. But it seems very clear that Charlotte used the school as an inspiration in her 1847 novel, Jane Eyre, with examples of the burnt porridge and frozen water being found in the book. The most awful days were Sundays. No matter the weather, the children had to walk more than 3 miles to St. John the Baptist Church in Tunstall to attend local Sunday service. They wouldn't walk back to school until late in the evening, after eating a cold snack at the back of the church building. When they got home, cold and famished, they were given nothing more than a slice of bread with a smear of rancid butter on it. Then there were more sermons after the meal and more studying of religious texts. For the Bronte sisters, their stay at the clergy daughter's school would be both emotionally traumatizing and physically damaging. Charlotte believed that the school's poor conditions led to permanent negative effects on her health and the health of her sisters, who would all have early deaths. Maria and Elizabeth, the eldest of the Bronte sisters, both died of tuberculosis in June of 1825. After their deaths, Patrick thankfully removed his remaining children from the school. Once they returned home, Charlotte began to act as the motherly friend and guardian of her younger sisters, and the siblings began taking lessons from their father and Aunt Branwell. Throughout her life, Charlotte was described as having dark mood swings and a volcanic temper. Each of the three sisters would grow up to have very different temperaments than one another. Charlotte was 5 when her mother died, whereas Anne was less than a year old. But just as well, Charlotte has vivid memories of their time at that terrible school. And again, Anne barely attended the school and was spared the torment in her formative years that her elder sisters had to go through. It was widely believed that their very different childhoods led to their respective temperaments. Charlotte struggled with what we now know to most likely be depression her entire life, but she called this bilious attacks, which would leave her confined to bed for days. She could also be sharp and harsh with those closest to her. One kind and described as inoffensive former employer was once brought to tears due to, quote, one or two rather plain home truths, which set her a-crying for 2 days and two nights together. On more than one occasion, she confessed to her close friend, Ellen Nussey, who we'll meet soon, don't deceive yourself by imagining that I have a bit of real goodness in me. If you knew my thoughts, the dreams that absorb me, and the fiery imagination that at times eats me up and makes me feel society, as it is, wretchedly inspired, you would pity me and, I dare say, despise me. And then, on the contrary, there was Anne. She was 4 years younger, and though she too felt similar strong feelings as her now eldest sister, Charlotte, she presented herself as calm and quiet. When her mother Maria died, Charlotte took it upon herself to be the caretaker for her youngest siblings. She'd place Anne on her knee and read a book that she had written for her about a little girl named Anne whose mother was very sick, but Anne would attend to the mother with much care and give her medicine. Anne and Charlotte would go on to have a little bit of drama amongst each other, so it's really sweet to hear about these kind of tender moments in their childhood together. Without having a mother of their own, it's understandable why the younger Bronte sisters would grow such an attachment to Charlotte. According to PsychologyToday.com, early parental loss is associated with some negative effects like anxiety, depression, prolonged grief reactions, negative sense of self, increased risk of suicide, substance abuse and eating problems, difficulty with executive functioning, reduced quality of life, and changes to how they approach adult relationships. Though I'm sure that each of these children, no matter what their age was aware of the tragedy and the trauma that was going on around them. But I think with Charlotte being the oldest, she was definitely the most aware of what was happening in their family and the loss that they were enduring. The siblings relied on each other, and the younger ones particularly on Charlotte to help give them the kind of love they were missing from their mother, which I'm sure also put a lot of weight and pressure on young Charlotte's shoulders as well. Emily was always seen as the quietest and most reclusive of the sisters, leading to a mysterious image that follows her reputation. That's one thing that I've always been jealous of about quiet people. They get to be cool and mysterious. I don't get to be those things. However, the younger sisters, Anne and Emily, had a very different relationship with each other than Charlotte did with either of them. Emily and Anne were described as being like twins. They were absolutely inseparable companions. Between Charlotte and Anne, however, a rift would begin to occur as the girls grew into young ladies. And it seems Emily just kind of stayed out of it, which seems like such middle child behavior. The kids' studies consisted of music and drawing, and each of the children learned to draw with some skill. One of the very famous paintings of the Bronte sisters is actually done by their brother Branwell, which is pretty cool. Aunt Branwell tried to teach the girls how to run a household, but they gravitated more toward literature than housekeeping. They read from many of their father's books written by authors like Homer and Shakespeare, as well as miscellaneous books and subjects of geography and biology. All of this reading fed their imagination and led to each of their interests in writing. Charlotte wrote her first known poem at the age of 13 in 1829. Many of her early poems were published, saying that in air quotes, in their homemade magazine called Branwell's Black Woods Magazine. The kids also wrote a story based off of a set of toy soldiers given to them by Branwell in June of 1826, developing characters for each of them and an imaginary world they called Angria, which even had an accompanying map and watercolor renderings of the land. In it, they created a fictional town they called Glasstown, and the remaining Bronte siblings created the shared world and began writing about the lives and struggles of its inhabitants. In Charlotte's personal letters, she referred to Glasstown as her world below and a private escape where she could act out her desires and multiple identities. She was fascinated with romantic settings, passionate relationships, and high society. Their brother Branwell, however, enjoyed writing about battles and politics. And the youngest sisters wrote about homely North Country realism. That was just a quote from my research. I have no idea what that actually means. Which put the siblings at odds with the content of their magazine. When Charlotte was 15 years old, she was sent to Roe Head School, where she would meet her lifelong friend, Ellen Nussey. Once befriending Charlotte, Ellen Nussey would become very close to the entire Bronte family. She would visit the Hawthorne Parsonage very often, and she really seems to be like the closest confidant of the sisters. After graduating as a student there, Charlotte would return to Roe Head School as a teacher between 1835 and 1858, where she lived an incredibly isolated and lonely existence. She also really hated the bratty kids she had to teach. So she took out her sorrows in poetry. With Charlotte gone around 1831, Anne and Emily broke away from their other siblings to create their own fantasy world they called Gondel, and the two grew particularly close. Emily then attended Roe Head School while her older sister worked as a teacher when she was 17 years old, but she dealt with some extreme homesickness and left after only a few months. Charlotte wrote later that the change from her own home to a school and from her own noiseless, very secluded, but unrestricted and unartificial mode of life to one of disciplined routine, though under the kindest auspices, was what she failed at enduring. I felt in my heart she would die if she did not go home, and with conviction obtained her recall. Emily was sent home and Anne was sent in her place. It was at Roe Head in 1835 that we would see the first signs of a rift between Anne and Charlotte. Charlotte was determined not to show any favoritism toward her sister, which left both of them feeling isolated and vulnerable. Charlotte began to hate teaching even more and the students she taught while battling a deep depression. Anne began to dive into her religious studies, falling into her own form of melancholy. Anne began to convince herself that she was a sinner who would be condemned to eternal torment. She soon became incredibly sick, most likely with typhoid. It was only then that Charlotte would turn into the sister that Anne needed, realizing how much she had been neglecting her and how much she needed her now. Anne thankfully recovered enough to return to Haworth, and Charlotte stayed behind at her teaching job for a while longer. Even now with both of her sisters gone, Charlotte's view of her teaching position did not improve. In fact, her contempt for her work and those around her only worsened. She began imagining that she was ridden with a hidden illness that no one knew about. When a doctor was called and brought to her, they told Charlotte to leave the school or she would die. Which is confusing to me. So are they saying that she'd die from the mysterious disease she's worried about, or die because she is clearly headed to an unhealthy place mentally? I'm not sure. As an adult, Emily began working as a teacher at Law Hill School in Halifax, beginning in September of 1838. However, her persistent health problems made working the 17-hour days incredibly difficult, and she only lasted one school year at the job. 17-hour days? What the fuck are you doing at that school? After her short soiree into the workforce, Emily decided to stay at home and take over most of the cooking and cleaning at Haworth. She also used her time to teach herself German, practice piano, and, of course, read and write. Though those around her seem to have been charmed by Emily, biographers have always had a hard time pinning down her personality and goings-on, as she had very few friends in adulthood outside of her family, Ellen Nussey, and another woman named Louise. All right, here we go. It's the first French pronunciation of the episode. Bassompierre, a fellow student she would soon meet in Brussels. Anne was Emily's closest friend. From 1839 to 1841, Charlotte took positions as a governess to families in Yorkshire, another form of work she absolutely despised. There's a story from when she was taking care of a particularly unruly child who once threw a Bible at her. And hey, girl, I feel you. I was once choked out by a 10-year-old who was much bigger and stronger than me, so... After her failed attempts at being a governess, Charlotte returned home to Haworth. Then she became one of many women in Haworth to fall for the new assistant curate, William Waitman. Charlotte would write about him in her letters and spent hours painting his portrait, which she was relentlessly teased for by her siblings. But then there was a quick and drastic change in her descriptions of William in her letters. She wrote of how he would fain persuade every woman under 30 whom he sees that he is desperately in love with her. In one letter to Ellen Nussey lie a clue as to what had changed her mind about him. She wrote that she had seen William watching Anne while sitting across from him in church, saying, quote, "He sits opposite Anne at church, sighing softly and looking out of the corners of his eyes to win her affection. And Anne is so quiet, her looks so downcast. they are a picture. Charlotte's publisher, George Smith, has opened up about how insecure Charlotte had been about her own appearance. She was apparently barely 5 feet tall. She very much disliked her small stature and what she considered to be her bad complexion. Apparently, she also had some missing teeth. She once allegedly told George Smith that she would have given all her genius and fame to be beautiful. However, Anne was described by most as the prettiest of the Bronte sisters. Ellen Nussey described her as gentle and quite different in appearance from the others. Her hair was a pretty light brown that fell in graceful curls. She had lovely violet blue eyes and fine penciled eyebrows and clear, almost transparent complexion. William Waitman unfortunately died at the young age of just 26 years old when he contracted cholera after visiting a sick parishioner. He seems like he was a really good guy. He was known to visit any of his parishioners who needed it and was also known to bring them little gifts to lift their spirits. And it seems that Anne, too, had fallen in love with William Waitman. In one of Anne's poems titled A Reminiscence, written in 1844, she wrote of a love for a man who was buried under the cold. It reads, "Yes, thou art gone and never more. Thy sunny smile shall gladden me. But I may pass the old church door and pace the floor that covers thee, may stand upon the cold, damp stone and think that frozen lies below the lightest heart that I ever known, the kindest I shall ever know. Yet though I cannot see thee more, 'tis still a comfort to have seen. And though thy transient life is o'er, 'tis sweet to think that thou hast been, to think a soul so near divine, within a form so angel fair, united to a heart like thine, has gladdened once our humble sphere." After leaving the Roehead School at the age of 19, Anne began seeking work as a teacher. Teaching or working as a governess were some of the only jobs available for poor and uneducated women like Anne at the time. After not having luck finding a teaching job, Anne began to work as a governess for the Ingham family. The children she was in charge of were spoiled and disobedient, and Anne really struggled to control them and had small success in educating them. She wasn't allowed to punish them, and when she complained about their behavior, she got no support and was criticized for being incapable. This sounds like when I worked for a certain model actress as a nanny. The Inghams grew frustrated with the lack of progress in her children and eventually dismissed Anne. From 1840 to 1845, though, Anne worked at Thorpe Green Hall, where she became the governess for Reverend Edmund Robinson and his wife, Lydia, who owned the school. At first, she faced issues there similar to at the Ingham House, and she became incredibly homesick on top of it. But she was also really determined to make this position work. Eventually, she got comfortable and became very well-liked by her employers and her charges. The Robinson girls would become lifelong friends of Anne's. She spent most of her time with the Robinson family as well, including holidays when she would travel with them to Scarborough. Anne only returned home briefly in 1842 when her beloved Aunt Branwell passed away. In January 1843, she returned to Thorpe Green and secured a job for her brother, Branwell, who would become a tutor to the Reverend's son. The fact that Anne was successful at being a governess where Charlotte was not may have been a sore spot for the eldest sister. Despite being shy, Anne had a way with people and was a good conversationalist when she had to be. The three Bronte sisters had all worked as governesses at one time in their lives, but Anne was the only one who was able to hold down the job for any length of time. The Robinsons loved and respected her so much that they even continued their relationship with her by exchanging letters after she left and would even make the trip to Haworth to see her every once in a while. That's honestly my goal with all of the children that I take care of. I want to be so good to them that they're going to want to reach out and spend time with me for the rest of their lives because they're all really important to me. It really does seem like the relationship between Charlotte and Anne was fraught from the start. Much of this, I'm sure, is due to intense jealousy and self-hatred. While this envy got in the way of their personal lives more often than not, it also bled into their soon-to-be professional lives.
You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. and you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series Toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
In 1842, Emily and Charlotte traveled to Brussels to attend a girls' academy. Oh gosh, here's the next word I'm going to pronounce terribly, I'm sure. Pensionnat Heger. To perfect their French and German in hopes of one day opening their own school. Emily loved Brussels, but Charlotte, on the other hand, felt out of place there and rendered herself to being a bit of an outcast. However, her teacher at the time, Constantine Heger, a doctor and scientist, wrote of her character glowingly and clearly thought very highly of her. The sisters considered staying longer than just the 1 year at the school to become teachers there themselves. But when Aunt Branwell died, they returned to Haworth. In 1844, Emily and Charlotte attempted to open this school in their house, but the plan was squashed when they were unable to attract students to come to their remote area. A year after leaving, Charlotte returned to Brussels to become a teacher herself at Pensionnat Heger. I can't tell you how difficult pronouncing French words is for me. My gosh, I keep wanting to say Hagar, but I feel like that's wrong. Now, I'm not sure if what I'm about to tell you started while she was a student at the school or if this all started happening after she returned to work as a teacher, but letters that were found later would reveal that Charlotte Bronte fell hopelessly in love with her married former tutor, Constantine Heger.
now known as the Heger Letters, they weren't printed until 1913 in the Times in London, long after Charlotte's death. Before the release of these letters, the prevailing image of Charlotte had been one of an angelic martyr to Christian and female duties, starting with Bronte's friend and biographer Elizabeth Gaskell's description of her. I'm going to get much further into their reputations and their legacies a little bit later on, so just put a pin in that. But these letters, revealing that she had once been in love with a married man with children, would drastically change that squeaky clean image. After spending another year in Brussels, she once again returned to Haworth, but her devotion to Heger never waned. The letters, mostly written in French, were written with high levels of emotional intensity, and she would write sometimes as frequently as twice a week. Heger rarely responded, which would leave Charlotte feeling devastated. She wrote, "Day and night, I find neither rest nor peace. If I sleep, I have tormenting dreams in which I see you, always severe, always saturnine and angry with me. Forgive me then, monsieur, if I take the step of writing you again. How can I bear my life unless I make an effort to alleviate its suffering?" Frustrated, Heger left the situation to his wife, Zoe Heger, to handle. Fucking great. She wrote to Charlotte, telling her that she may only write to her husband once every 6 months at the most. Honestly, that's pretty nice of her. I feel like most wives would be like, go away, stop contacting my husband entirely. Heger then tore up all of Charlotte's letters. But Zoe fetched a few from the garbage and stitched them together for preservation purposes. 40 years after Charlotte died in 1894, one of Heger's daughters showed one of the recovered letters to a former pupil of her father's, Frederica MacDonald. At first, Frederica told her friend to keep the letters a secret, fearing that the public wouldn't understand the now super famous author's feelings for her former tutor. Frederica believed that the letters weren't an ordinarily improper affection, but a consuming sentiment burning down to self-respect and self-restraint. But though she tried not to judge, Frederica's opinion of the once lauded goody-two-shoes of the literary world had changed. It seems that she may have possibly taken her change of heart to Heger's daughter, who then donated the four surviving letters to the British Library in 1913. Reading passages from these letters feels both sad and familiar. Charlotte wrote about not needing much affection from those who she loves, saying, "I would not know what to do with a whole and complete friendship. I am not accustomed to it. But you showed me a little interest in me days gone by when I was a pupil in Brussels, and I cling to the preservation of this little interest. I cling to it as I would cling to life." It is believed that Heger inspired the character of Mr. Rochester in Jane Eyre. But whereas Mr. Rochester reciprocated Jane's love, the real-life Mr. Rochester did not reciprocate his feelings with the real Jane. All three of the Bronte sisters had deep and sometimes dark inner lives. I can only imagine the torment and heartbreak that Charlotte must have felt, loving someone who didn't reciprocate those feelings once again. Back at home, Emily began finding and compiling the poems and stories that she had written as a child. In the fall of 1845, Charlotte came across the notebooks full of her sister's work and began encouraging her to publish them. Emily at first was furious with her sister for invading her privacy, but I'm sure she was also bolstered by her big sister's apparent faith in her and her writing ability. Emily eventually stopped being mad at Charlotte when Charlotte showed her that she too had been putting together her old manuscripts and writing in secret as well. One of the most prominent pieces in Emily's collection were the Gondel stories that she and Anne had written when they were children. Anne and Emily had always kept Charlotte out of their Gondel stories and only shared what they had written with each other when they were children. But now as adults, Charlotte was able to read them, and it seems she thought they were good enough for others to read as well. The Bronte sisters published their first volume of poems, Poems by Currer, Ellis, and Acton Bell, in 1846. Charlotte's pseudonym was Currer, Emily's was Ellis, and Anne's was Acton. Like many female authors of this time and before, they chose to take male-sounding pseudonyms in order to keep their chances at getting published and getting their work noticed by the public. In this book of poems, Charlotte contributed 19, and Emily and Anne both contributed 21. The book shows Emily as being undoubtedly the best poet of the three, but Anne's verses were also seen as far superior to Charlotte's. Several months after the book was published, they were told that only 2 copies had sold. But one of the readers would be such a fan that he had even requested an autographed copy of his book. With that, the girls weren't deterred and continued writing in hopes of being published more. Also, before I forget to mention it, their brother Branwell would also become a prolific writer. He wrote and published a number of poems both by himself and with his sisters. By June of 1846, packages containing the manuscripts of the 3 sisters' first novels began traveling around town. Charlotte's The Professor, Emily's Wuthering Heights, and Anne's Agnes Grey. After a few rejections, Wuthering Heights and Agnes Grey were accepted by publisher Thomas Cotley Newby. Newby did not, however, agree to publish Charlotte's novel, The Professor. I can imagine the jealousy brewing in Charlotte when this happened, that both of her little sisters were sidestepping her on her way to success. However, Jane Eyre was just about complete at this time, and the book would also be published within the same year as her sisters' novels in 1847. Anne's Agnes Grey was the first of the 3 novels to be published, and the story follows a governess, Agnes Grey, as she works for a high society English family. The novel is most likely inspired by the 5 years that Anne spent working as a governess for the Robinsons. It's also believed that the character Edward Weston was very much inspired by William Wakeman. Agnes deals with issues such as oppression, isolation, and abuse while working as a governess. An additional theme is the fair treatment of animals. Agnes Grey has also been described as a coming-of-age story. The second book to be published would be Emily's only novel, Wuthering Heights. The book is about 2 families, the Earnshaws and the Lintons, who live in the Yorkshire Moors, and their turbulent relationship with Earnshaw's foster son, Heathcliff, who is described as a, quote, dark-skinned gypsy. See last week's episode for more on that last little comment. When the book was initially published, the public and critics seemed uncomfortable with some of the subject matter, which includes domestic abuse, mental and physical cruelty, religion, and the English class system. Many people also assumed that the book was written by a man, not only because the book was published under Emily's pseudonym, Ellis, but because of the violence and passion in the book, which led a lot of people to believe that a woman couldn't have written such a thing. According to Anne Bronte historian Juliet Gardner, the vivid sexual passion and power of its language and imagery impressed, bewildered, and appalled reviewers. However, Emily unfortunately would never hear of any of the positive or negative thoughts and opinions on her book, as she would be dead before its publication. It took just 6 weeks between the failure of The Professor and a successful sale of Charlotte's new book, Jane Eyre, which would be published in October of 1847. Jane Eyre, published under the pseudonym Currer again, is about a governess, Jane, and her challenging upbringing, which led her to fall in love with her employer, Mr. Rochester. They eventually marry after Mr. Rochester's wife dies mysteriously in a house fire. Jane Eyre had immediate success and received rave reviews, though there was much speculation as to the true gender of the book's author, as it so perfectly displayed the story through the female character's perspective. After the publication of Agnes Grey, Anne began working on another manuscript entitled The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, which would be published in June of 1848, again under the pseudonym Acton Bell. The novel is constructed as a series of letters between Gilbert Markham and his friend about events that occurred when he met with a young widow who called herself Helen Graham, who had arrived at Wildfell Hall with her young son and a servant. Helen subverts from gender norms of the time, making a living as an artist, secluding herself from most of the world. Being such a recluse, rumors began to spread around town about her, but Gilbert decides to befriend her. Helen then gives Gilbert her diary in which she describes her presumably dead husband's decline into alcoholism and violence. He learns that Helen actually fled with her son. If you'll recall from my episode covering divorce laws, until the Married Women's Property Act of 1870 was passed, a married woman had no legal existence independent from her husband and could not own property nor sue for custody of their children. In this novel, Helen's husband had every right to reclaim her and even charge her with the kidnapping of their child if she was ever found. By creating her own income with her paintings, she was also technically stealing her husband's property, since that income legally belonged to him. Most critics now consider The Tenant of Wildfell Hall to be an early feminist novel, One review disliked the way the novel represented women as superior in every quality, moral and intellectual, to all men. I mean, hey, that sounds pretty great to me. One review said that Wildfell Hall was a people's novel of a very different school. It is, taken altogether, a powerful and an interesting book. Not that it is a pleasant book to read, nor, as we fancy, has it been a pleasant book to write. Still less has it been a pleasant training which could teach an author such awful facts or give courage to write them. The fault of the book is coarseness, not merely that coarseness of subject which will be the stumbling block of most readers and which makes it utterly unfit to be put in the hands of girls. But he added that English society owes thanks, not sneers, to those who dare shew at the image of her own ugly, hypocritical visage. Another way that the novel showed differing gender expectations was in the way that Anne wrote the emotional nature of the male character Gilbert in the book, which was also noted as a positive in reviews. However, no critic could believe that anyone but a man could write the book, with one saying, "Despite reports of the contrary, no woman could have written such a work." And I have to add just one more review for comedy's sake, as the North American Review quoted Wildfell Hall as being less unpleasant than Wuthering Heights. Aw, gotta love that sibling rivalry. While the young women were riding high on the successes of their first published novels, unfortunately, tragedy would soon befall the Bronte family. It was first their beloved brother Branwell whose health would begin to decline. He had been working as a tutor to the son of Reverend Edmund Robinson since January 1843 at Thorpe Green Hall, and in that time, he had fallen in love with the Reverend's wife, Lydia, who was 15 years his senior. He was eventually dismissed from his position in July of 1845, apparently after having received an incredibly stern letter telling him to leave, and with an order to break off all communication with every member of the Reverend's family. And it does seem to me that it was likely that this affair between Branwell and Lydia did actually occur, as there is evidence of Branwell receiving payment from Thorpe Green sent by Mrs. Robinson personally. And that has been taken to be bribe money in order to keep Branwell quiet about the affair. And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. I think that Branwell also held out hope that maybe one day they would get together. And in the meantime, back home, he looked for another job and wrote poetry. But when he heard news of Reverend Robinson's death, and he didn't hear from Lydia, he was heartbroken. According to a biography of Branwell, he then declined into chronic alcoholism, opiates, and debt. His behavior became increasingly difficult and humiliating for the family, especially after once having set fire to his own bed, after which his father had to sleep with him for the safety of his family. Branwell passed away on Sunday, September 24, 1848, most likely due to tuberculosis, aggravated by his use of drugs and alcohol. At his funeral 1 week later, Emily caught a bad cold, which quickly developed into inflammation of the lungs, leading to tuberculosis. As her condition steadily worsened, Emily refused medical intervention. On the morning of December 19, 1848, Charlotte wrote, "She grows weaker daily. The physician's opinion was expressed too obscurely to be of use. He sent some medicine, which she would not take. Moments so dark as these I have never known. I pray for God's support to us all." By noon that same day, Emily had gotten even worse. In her last audible words, she told Charlotte, "If you will send for a doctor, I will see him now." But it was too late. She died at about 2 p.m. that day. Charlotte's letter to a friend described her sister dying beside her beloved dog, Keeper, who was lying on the side of her deathbed. Besides her sisters, Keeper seems to be Emily's best friend. Their relationship was described like this. "Poor old Keeper, Emily's faithful friend and worshiper, seemed to understand her like a human being. Sometimes Emily would delight in showing off Keeper, make him frantic in action, and roar with the voice of a lion. It was a terrifying exhibition within the walls of an ordinary sitting room. Keeper was a solemn mourner at Emily's funeral and never recovered his cheerfulness." After her death,
Charlotte described her sister this way. My sister's disposition was not naturally gregarious. Circumstances favored and fosters her tendency to seclusion. Except to go to church or take a walk on the hills, she rarely crossed the threshold of home. Though her feeling for the people round was benevolent, intercourse with them she never sought, nor with very few exceptions ever experienced. And yet she knew them, knew their ways, their language, their family histories. She could hear of them with interest and talk of them with detail, minute, graphic, and accurate. But with them, she rarely exchanged a word. The Literary News in 1883 stated that Emily loved solemn moors. She loved all wild, free creatures and things. Emily's death greatly affected Anne. The cycle of sickness continued as Anne's physical health began to decline as she grieved her sister. Just days after Emily's death, over Christmas, Anne contracted influenza, which eventually worsened in January when a doctor diagnosed her with advanced consumption, or tuberculosis, with little hope of making a recovery. This was no surprise, especially since Emily and Branwell passed away from tuberculosis, and most likely they passed it on to their sister. This disease is spread from one person to the next through the air by people who have active TB. But Anne didn't seem to be distressed by the news of her approaching death. She wrote in a letter to Ellen Newsy, "I have no horror of death. If I thought it inevitable, I think I could quite resign myself to the prospect. But I wish it would please God to spare me not only for Papa's and Charlotte's sakes, but because I long to do some good in the world before I leave it. I have many schemes in my head for future practices, humble and limited indeed, but still I should not like them all to come to nothing, and myself to have lived to so little purpose. But God's will be done." Unlike her sister, Anne followed the doctor's advice and took all of the medication prescribed to her. In this time, Charlotte and Anne decided to come clean to their publisher about their true identities, with Charlotte famously telling them, "We are three sisters." In February, Anne seemed a little bit better. So Anne, along with Charlotte and Ellen Newsy, traveled to Scarborough to see if a change in location and fresh sea air would benefit Anne further. And with this, I want to ask, why do doctors never prescribe a nice sea air vacation anymore? Because that sounds lovely. On May 24th, 1849, the women set out for York, pushing Anne around in a wheelchair while they did some shopping. But after this trip, it became apparent that Anne had little strength left. The sisters wondered if they should stay in Scarborough or make the trip back to Haworth for Anne to die. They decided to stay in Scarborough, as the doctor who visited them told the women that Anne didn't have much time left. Anne died around 2 o'clock p.m. on Monday, May 28, 1849, at the age of 29. Charlotte decided to lay the flower where it had fallen and bury her sister in Scarborough. At the funeral, held on May 30th, it was only Charlotte, Ellen Newsy, and a former schoolmistress from Roe Head, Miss Wooler, who attended. The stone that Charlotte had commissioned to be placed over her sister's grave was given the inscription, "Here lie the remains of Anne Bronte, daughter of Reverend P. Bronte, incumbent of Haworth, Yorkshire. She died aged 28, May 28, 1849. It wasn't until Charlotte visited the gravesite 3 years later that she noticed the numerous mistakes she had made on her sister's headstone. She had it redone, but Charlotte didn't catch all of her errors, and the headstone remained stating that Anne was 28 when she passed, when in reality she was 29. Thankfully, in 2011, a new plaque was installed by Anne's grave. The original inscription had become almost completely illegible in places, and it also couldn't be restored. On the new plaque, they copied the old inscription, but made sure to correct all of the mistakes this time. Come on, Charlotte, she's your sister! After her death, Charlotte addressed the multitude of issues she had with the first edition of Anne's Agnes Grey and began her long vendetta to oppress the tenant of Wildfell Hall from future publication. The book was being prepared to be republished, as was Emily's Wuthering Heights, but Charlotte wrote in 1850 that Wildfell Hall, it hardly appears to me desirable to preserve. The choice of subject in that work is a mistake. It was too little consonant with character, tastes and ideas of the gentle, retiring, inexperienced writer. Many have speculated as to whether Charlotte truly felt this way about the novel, or if she was just envious that the book had been successful and it had been published quicker than hers. With her sister no longer around to create more work or defend her past work, Charlotte could take control of the narrative regarding her sister's legacies. Charlotte also told the publisher that Anne's novel had been an entire mistake, and that's why it did not seem worthy of republishing. Subsequent critics also began to pay less attention to Anne's work and began dismissing her as the Bronte without genius. And Agnes Grey was suppressed for the next 10 years after Anne's death. While the novel was still printed in the United States, as there were differing copyright laws, Charlotte actively suppressed the radical feminist piece of art her sister created, most likely for the sake of her own star rising. The idea of it being in regards to her jealousy is further displayed in a letter that she wrote to her publisher, William S. Williams, what a name, saying that Wildfell Hall had faults of execution, faults of art, was obvious, but faults of intention of feeling could be suspected by none who knew the writer. For my part, I consider the subject unfortunately chosen. It was one the author was not qualified to handle at once vigorously and truthfully. The simple and natural, quiet description and simple pathos are, I think, Acton Bell's forte. I liked Agnes Grey better than the present work. Some say that the reason Charlotte suppressed the book was a way to protect her youngest sister's legacy from further criticism. But all of the sisters received pretty harsh criticisms for their work, so her choice to particularly single out Anne's work is strange. Historian Juliet Barker said that Charlotte was, quote, prepared to co-sign her sister's novel to oblivion because she considered its subject at odds with her own perception of what Anne's character was and ought to have been. There you have it. Thankfully, Wildfell Hall has remained relevant, despite Anne's own sister's efforts to destroy it. Publishers respected Charlotte's wishes until shortly before her death in 1854, when the London firm Thomas Hodgson issued a one-volume edition of The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. After performing extensive editing on the novel, this is so infuriating, get this. Hodgson removed many sections, including the chapter headings and the opening letter at the start of the book. Some single words were missing, and some complete chapters disappeared, and some sections were then rearranged to compensate. Why? And after that, other publishers began producing their own mutilated text, including the Bronte sisters' original publishers, Smith, Elder & Company. These copies are even prevalent to this day, despite notes on the covers claiming them to be complete and unabridged. I'm going to have to be really careful when I go to purchase my own copy of The Tenants of Wildfell Hall to make sure it's legit. Since the mid-20th century, Anne's life and her work have been given more attention. There were biographies written about the forgotten Bronte sister in 1959, 1989, and 1991. In 2013, it was said that in some ways, Anne is now viewed as the most radical of the sisters, writing about tough subjects such as women's need to maintain independence and how alcoholism can tear a family apart. It's about damn time. After the deaths of her siblings, Charlotte picked up on the novel she had begun before the tragedies, Shirley, which would be published in October of 1849. Shirley was not as eagerly accepted by critics, and reviewers were disappointed that it was less shocking than Jane Eyre had been. In lieu of the success of her novels, George Smith, her publisher, persuaded Charlotte to come out of the closet of sorts and make trips to London to reveal her true identity to the rest of the world. In London, Charlotte began to move in high society social circles, becoming friends with English novelist Elizabeth Gaskell and English social theorist Harriet Martineau. The three women shared an interest in race relations and the abolitionist movement, which were recurring themes in all of their writing. Charlotte would never stay in London for more than a few weeks at a time, though, as she didn't want to leave her aging father for too long. In 1853, Charlotte received a marriage proposal from an Irishman named Arthur Bell Nichols, who was now her father's curate, who had been in love with her for years. Patrick Bronte initially refused the proposal due to Arthur's poor financial status, and Charlotte didn't seem too keen on the idea of marrying him either. But Elizabeth Gaskell thought that the marriage would be good for her, as she believed marriage in general provided clear and defined duties that were beneficial to women. gag me with a spoon. Elizabeth also made use of some of her contacts to arrange improvements on Arthur's finances. Little by little, Charlotte began to fall for Arthur. And by January of 1854, she accepted his marriage proposal. By April, they had convinced Charlotte's dad to let them marry, and they wed by June. Soon after the wedding, Charlotte became pregnant. But now her health, too, was rapidly declining. She would have horrible spells of perpetual nausea and faintness, far more than was the norm for morning sickness in pregnancy. She would die on March 31st, 1855, just 3 weeks before her 39th birthday. On her death certificate, they listed phthisis as the cause of death, but it was actually most likely due to dehydration and malnourishment due to the incessant vomiting leading up to her death. Looking into it, she essentially died from having an incredibly severe form of morning sickness, also called hypermesis gravidarum. Don't worry though, because this is super rare and only occurs in like 0.3 to 2% of pregnancies. And today there's ways of taking care of it. However, bestie Ellen Newsy accused Nichols of being that wicked man who was the death of dear Charlotte. Elizabeth Gaskell called him bigoted. As for their father, Patrick Bronte, he would go on to outlive both his wife by 40 years and every single one of his 6 children. Between 1849 and 1850, he organized action to procure a clean water supply for the village, which was eventually achieved in 1856. He also began working with Elizabeth Gaskell on the biography of his daughter Charlotte and was responsible for the posthumous publication of Charlotte's first novel, The Professor, in 1857. Arthur Nichols stayed in Patrick's home until Patrick's death at the age of 84 in 1861, and by that time, Arthur returned to Ireland. In 1857, the first biography of Charlotte Bronte was published. The novel was written by Charlotte's friend, Elizabeth Gaskell, which was a big deal at the time to have a female novelist write a biography of another. Gaskell's biography was also unique for the time in that it didn't just focus on the professional achievements of Charlotte's life, but also the personal details. But the biography, however, was not fully fleshed out and honest, as Elizabeth omitted some of the more scandalous moments of her friend's life, as well as getting a few details wrong, such as claiming that Patrick Bronte didn't let his kids eat meat, which was refuted by one of Emily's diary entries where she discusses making a dinner of meat and potatoes at the parsonage. Ellen Newsy had kept about 350 of the 500 or so letters that Charlotte had written to her over the span of their lifelong friendship. However, none of Ellen's letters to Charlotte survived, as they were all burned upon her husband Arthur Nichols's request. These letters give the most information into Charlotte Bronte's true life and thoughts, and they have become the backbone for most biographies on her since. There's been some questioning over the nature of the relationship between Ellen and Charlotte due to these letters, as some people read a hint of romantic undertones in them, and I'd say I have to agree. Here's an example. In one such letter, Charlotte wrote to Ellen, "What shall I do without you? How long are we likely to be separated? Why are we to be denied each other's society? I long to be with you. Why are we to be divided? Surely, Ellen, it must be because we are in danger of loving each other too well." And hey, we don't know, but it isn't out of the question that Charlotte had romantic or sexual interest in her friend, and she would have been aware of same-sex relationships as apparently she lived very close to Anne Lister, or Gentleman Jack, who I've also discussed on the podcast. Now again, there's no proof that the Bronte sisters and Anne Lister had any kind of relationship, but I did find evidence of the possibility of their paths crossing multiple times in their lives, and that's pretty interesting. Overall, Gaskell painted Charlotte as the victim supreme, from a tragic childhood in which she lost her mother very young, to the terrible treatment at the boarding school she and her sisters attended, to even more tragedy in the family, all while creating literary masterpieces that were deep, meaningful, and progressive. But every bit of Charlotte's sexuality was erased from Gaskell's story, making Charlotte almost appear plain and boring to the average reader. There was absolutely no indication of her affection for William Waitman or for her married former tutor and boss. In years since, her reputation has changed from that of a wallflower to that of a bit of a fame whore, if you ask me. She once wrote that she pined to be forever known, and that seems to be her main motivator in life. She was also known to be blunt and rude, once referring to Jane Austen's Emma in a letter saying Austen ruffles her reader with nothing vehement, disturbs him by nothing profound. The passions are perfectly unknown to her. The unseen seer of life and the sentient target of death, Miss Austen ignores. She also once said of her rival, Miss Austen is not a poetess. Can there ever be a great artist without poetry? Charlotte Bronte is a damn hater. It's amazing that three women who would only live until the ages of 29, 30, and 38, respectively, would have such a full and lasting legacy. Maybe it's due to the shortness of their lives and the genius of their work that has continued our fascination with these three sisters. Charlotte's coldness and perceived brilliance, Emily's kindness and quiet reserve, and Anne's radical mind and caring heart have lasted across decades and generations of young readers, particularly women, as I think that each of us can see a little bit of ourselves in Charlotte, Emily, and Anne. Now, I know there is so much more to each of their stories, and I cannot wait to read their novels, watch the movies and TV shows made about them. I've definitely grown much more interested in the Bronte sisters after this week. If you are a fan of theirs and you feel like there is something huge that I missed, I would love to hear about it. So send me an email at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com or send me a DM on Instagram at @angryneighborhoodfeminist and be sure to follow me over there. I'm going to finish up this episode right here, right now, but I did want to remind you all of the scheduling change once again. I am no longer, at the moment, releasing mini episodes on Fridays, and I will be releasing hour-long, full-length news episodes in the last week of each month. At least for the time being, I've decided that that is going to be my schedule. And I'm working on a list of topics that I want to cover in that episode. So if there's anything specific going on in the news that you want me to talk about, also please email me those suggestions, send me a DM. I really want to talk about what you want to hear about. Okay, that's all I have for you today. With all that being said, I encourage you to rage on. Bye.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that, as well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.